Okay, we're beginning a new section today. Before we launch into this very intensely fraught topic of race, I want to just recapitulate the very last bit of the lecture on poverty and inequality, because this also bears on some of the issues we'll discuss on race, since part of the issue around race is its intersection with inequality, not just race as such, but how race, class, and poverty are bound up with each other. So I just wanted to just quickly review the four, what I added one, what I would describe as four kinds of structural proposals for really, once and for all, solving the problem of poverty. And the backdrop to this is our prior discussion where we drew the contrast between blame the victim and blame society as a kind of stylized way of thinking about explanations for inequality and poverty, in which if you decide that a lot of the explanation for why we have such high levels of persistent poverty really has to do with the nature of our social structures and institutions, and not primarily because of flaws in the persons, deficits in the persons as such, well, if that's really the diagnosis, then the cure, to use a medical analogy, is you have to change the institutions. You have to do something to reorder the underlying structure that sustains such high levels of poverty. And here, I think, are four basic approaches. These are all structural changes. They're policies. There's ways of changing the environment in which people live their lives, the environment in which their individual attributes then are consequential for their opportunities in life. So first, we can partially decouple standards of living from market earnings by increasing the social wage. That's all the parts of our standards of living that simply don't depend upon how much you earn. Public swimming pools rather than country clubs as a kind of stylized way of thinking about it. Libraries rather than bookstores as a way of getting books. Free public education rather than all private schools where you pay, and so on. So increasing the social wage does reduce poverty. Second, we can partially decouple paid employment from the capitalist market through public sector jobs. The standard way of thinking about the public sector employment is that it's the employer of, quote, last resort. Now, that implies that there's something more authentic or real or genuine or desirable about jobs that are created in the market compared to jobs that we create through our public understanding that we need some tasks done which the market simply doesn't provide. If it were the case that that was an empty set, if there simply wasn't anything that we needed to be done to improve the quality of life in our society, nothing to be done outside of the market, well, then we'd have a problem. To create public sector jobs would be creating jobs that weren't needed. But that's simply not the case. There's a large number of things that need to be done that simply won't be done through market employment, and therefore there's good reason to create public sector jobs. And the nice thing about public sector jobs is that if you create them, you can design them to pay a living wage. You don't have to leave it up to the market. You know, you can just decide any job that we're going to provide democratically to solve problems will be a job that provides a living wage. It doesn't mean they have to be high paid, they just have to be well paid jobs. And that's another way of dealing with poverty, just by creating jobs by design through public effort. Third, you can partially decouple income from earnings with an unconditional basic income. Now, that's probably the most controversial, or at least the most novel, of the ideas that I presented. An unconditional basic income is now part of the public discussion. It's getting some traction. You hear it in the news periodically these days. I think it's a very good idea. I think it's likely to happen in the course of the next decades. As automation increases, as the problem of the scarcity of jobs, even for middle class people, increases, as this problem of creating an adequate amount of market-based employment in a rich society becomes a problem, there is this solution, which is to decouple the basic minimum standard of living from the labor market altogether. And then this expands the space in which people can create their own jobs, their own work. It increases individual freedom. You can think of this as an unconditional basic grant of freedom to everyone. Everyone has at their disposal the same basic level of real freedom. Think of it that way rather than just basic income. Because income is the means for making choices. And above all, the ability to say no. Well, I went through that last time and it's discussed in the book. I think it's worth really thinking about it. It's a nice thing to argue with your friends. Just propose it and have a good discussion about it. It's a very provocative idea, I think. And finally, I mentioned this already, but I think it's worth emphasizing. Let's make the minimum wage a living wage. Let's just raise the minimum wage to the point where a person can live on a job, a full-time job, paying the minimum wage. This is entirely possible. This is a little graph distilled from an article in the New York Times. It shows a Burger King worker in Denmark. Big Macs, this is a couple years ago, Big Macs in Denmark do cost a little more than in the United States. 80 cents a Big Mac more. The Big Mac is the same. It's a kind of standardized product. That's a nice thing about Big Macs, because they're made all over the world and they're the same everywhere because of the standardization of the McDonald's Corporation. You can make comparisons across the world. It's sometimes called the Big Mac standard. You know, you can check the cost of living in different places by just seeing how much do Big Macs cost. Well, look at this table. The hourly wage in the United States is $8.60 for a Burger King worker. In Denmark, it's a minimum of $20 an hour. That's a huge difference, $20 an hour versus $8.60 an hour. And yet, it only results in an 80 cents increase in a Big Mac. Now, you know, if you ask most people, would you be willing to pay 80 cents more for a hamburger if it meant that the people producing it had a living wage rather than a below living standard wage? You know, most people would say, yeah, that seems like a pretty good trade-off. I'll pay a little more for a Big Mac and people will have a living wage. In Denmark, this guy, I can't read his name, this Danish Big Mac worker, gets 5 weeks of paid vacation. He gets paid paternity leave if he has a baby in his family. He gets overtime pay for working evenings and Sundays, unlike in American Burger Kings. And he's unionized, unlike fast food places in the United States. And yet with all of those extra benefits and extra constraint upon the employer, that's what the unionization does, and extra rules imposed on the employer, they have to give paid vacation in Denmark. And maternity, paternity leave. In spite of all that, it only costs 80 cents more a Big Mac. And that's, I think, the important thing to realize. You'll see in the debate, there's going to be debate in the course of the next year or so, for sure, about the minimum wage. There's a movement to raise the minimum wage in the United States to $15 an hour. And you'll hear all sorts of arguments that if you raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, it's going to force small businesses out of business. That they can't afford a minimum wage of $15 an hour. And there's two things to think about in that respect. First of all, of course people are going to say that. Employers would rather pay less. So first of all, you should always take such arguments with a grain of salt because they're self-serving. But let's suppose it's even true. Well, what's the problem of getting rid of jobs in the United States that don't pay a living wage? Wouldn't it be a good thing if we had no jobs in the United States that didn't pay a living wage? What's wrong with that? Well, what's wrong with it is that it might increase unemployment. But that's only a problem if the only way you can solve unemployment is by having the labor market provide the jobs, right? if you somehow feel the private sector is some sacred zone of job creation and jobs created outside of the private sector are not real jobs, then the unemployment created by saying, no, we're not going to have in a rich society people working for less than a living wage, the unemployment created for that is not a problem. You just have to create public sector jobs to make up the difference. There really is no inherent reason for having a chronic unemployment problem in a rich country. You just have to pay for having job creation. So the mix of having high minimum wage, living wage jobs, and a somewhat larger public sector of employment, that seems to me a desirable mix. And a mix that would do a tremendous amount to certainly reduce the problem of chronic poverty, persistent poverty, and reduce inequality, because you would be reducing it at the bottom. It would certainly reduce it, and I think arguably such policies, if put in place and sustained in place, could come very close to eliminating poverty. Poverty in the midst of plenty is simply not a law of nature. It's a result of the way we organize our institutions and our social life. Now on to the next topic, race. There's hardly any topic in this course, I think, which has deeper and more complex resonance with moral problems in American history. Race is a difficult issue to talk about. You hear a lot about the need for more conversation, as it's called, about race. It is a difficult thing to talk about. It's especially a difficult thing for white people to talk about, people who don't experience in their immediate day-to-day lives what the meaning of race is and why it matters so much. It's a difficult issue. It's also, it turns out, if you can detach yourself from the fraught history of it for a moment, it also turns out that it's an extremely interesting problem intellectually, this category, race, and how it works in social life. You know, it's a really interesting issue. You know, if you're an anthropologist and you go to some exotic culture that you don't know anything about, let's say a hunting and gathering society that's been untouched by industrialism and Western civilization. This is was more common in the 19th century, but still occasionally there are these isolated groups of people who live in a pre-agricultural way. They live as hunters and gatherers. Anthropologists always are impressed by the what seems to them as the strange classification systems that such communities create. There are clans that are owl clans and bear clans, and this really means something to people, and they care about which clan you're in. And the bearness and owlness and coyote-ness of different clans is deeply ingrained in how people imagine the world and think about social distinction. And this is usually viewed often in a kind of Eurocentric, patronizing way as an interesting exotic curiosity. Well, I think if Marjan anthropologists were to descend to the United States and try to figure out this strange place that they are studying and ask people questions and observe, did their anthropological stuff, they would be scratching their heads and going back to Mars, using Mars, of course, as a metaphor. I doubt if there are very many anthropologists on Mars. But in any case, they'd scratch their heads and they would wonder, what in the world is this classification system that everybody seems to carry around with them? This classification system of race, it just doesn't make any sense. What is it all about? Well, this is a weird classification system. It's weird, but incredibly powerful. And its forms of institutionalization in our history has been incredibly damaging to the lives of people. Well, that's my my little homily to begin our discussion. Now let's really begin to try to unpack this idea. So first, what is race and what is racism? We need a vocabulary. You know, this is a common move that I make at the beginning of each section, right? We have to get our concepts lined up, get our ducks in a row, and then we can get on with the business of explaining and studying things. What is race? Well, I'm going to give you a pretty complex definition of race as a social phenomenon. It has four principal components. This is a little bit more elaborately stated than in the book, but it's essentially the same definition. First, race is a classification system of human beings. Lots of different classification systems. Male, female, tall, short, athletic, unathletic, nerdy, unnerdy, you know. There's many ways you can classify people. Race is one of the many different ways we classify people. It's a classification system of human beings that is socially created. That is sometimes the term that sometimes used is socially constructed. You'll see that expression, the social construction of race. All that really means is it's socially created. On the basis of culturally defined, biologically transmitted group characteristics. So race is somehow or other connected to biology that's transmitted. You're born with a race, and you know a person's race by knowing the race of the parents, and you know their race by knowing the race of their parents, and so on. So race is something that's transmitted biologically. But here's the weird thing about it. It's transmitted biologically, but it's not a biological category. It's a social category that takes biological facts and transforms them, constructs them, thus socially created, transforms them into a salient classification system. That's why it's a complicated way of issue. Takes biological raw materials, that is, it is something you inherit from your parents, and what, you know, if it's descended through your parents, it's somehow or other biological. But the classification is not itself a biological classification. It's a social classification that just takes that as the raw material with which to concoct pretty screwy classification systems. Typically, but not invariably, these are connected to visible attributes. That's the typical way that racial coding takes place, is by physical attributes. But we know that there are deeply racist classification systems that have virtually nothing to do with physical attributes. The Nazi classification of people into Jews and non-Jews, Jews and Aryans, was a racial classification. How do you know a person's a Jew? You know it because their parents were Jewish. How do you know they were Jewish? Because their parents were Jewish. It's something passed on from parents to children. But there were blonde, blue-eyed Jews, and there were swarthy Jews, and there were Jews with the stereotypical caricatured, you know, facial features, and Jews that were just utterly indistinguishable from anybody else in the German cultural context. Because it wasn't the physical attributes that defined a person as Jewish, nor was it really religion. Although, of course, historically, the term Jew is a term connected to religion. No, it's a descent rule that defines you as a Jew. That's why even if you converted to Christianity, you were still persecuted. Conversion didn't protect you because it was a racial classification system, a racial classification system. There's a wonderful story that's buzzing around the internet about two little boys, Reddy and Jax, J-A-X, six-year-old boys who were best friends. They decided to trick their school teacher by going to the barber and getting identical haircuts. And they thought they really looked alike, they're about the same size, they had the same kind of smile. They would really fool their teacher by getting exactly the same haircuts. And sure enough, they got their same haircuts. The mother apparently told the teacher to go along with it. And the teacher the next day confused the two of them back and forth. Now, you know, it's a beautiful, endearing story. I'm assuming it's a true story. Things like this could be on the internet without it actually being true. I don't know. I mean, I don't know the mom to check with her to see, did this really happen? But I've been around little kids enough to know that there are kids who grow up in an interactive context in which they don't really notice. It's just a variation, but it's not a classification yet. And that certainly seems to be the case for these two little boys. And you can kind of see, if they weren't paying any attention to what we consider the salient classification of skin color, if that wasn't what they were paying attention to, you can see how they thought, oh, get the same haircut, about the same size, we both got prominent ears and big smiles, ha, we'll fool the teacher. So race is a socially created classification system. Here's a little way to just think about this that just makes this completely obvious, if kind of uncomfortably obvious. In the United States, in the early 20th century, when the Jim Crow laws were being instituted and the racial classification was being codified in law in new ways, right? So you had a system of segregation. You had drinking fountains that were whites only and colored only. You had schools that were only for white kids and separate schools for black kids. Well, you had to put into law a rule. How do you know somebody's white or black? And the rule that was put in is what has been known colloquially as the one-drop rule. And that's kind of the way the classification system has persisted. That is, if you have any ancestors of African descent, if you have any African ancestors, you're black. So you could be 1/8 black and you're classified as black in the American classification system. Now, that's not a historically universal one. In some countries, they have a very much more elaborate set of gradations. They have, you know, mulattoes and quadroons and octoons, that's an eighth. In one place in the United States, that more complicated classification system has had some currency, and that's Louisiana. But that's because Louisiana had French heritage. It's because in the Francophone part of the world, when racial classifications were concocted, they were concocted in a different way from the rest of the United States, in that more fine-grained way. You'd have all these different gradations rather than it being binary. Well, we decided that the binary rule was any black makes you black. Now, just imagine a different kind of racial ideology, which classified exactly symmetrically, but in the other direction. A one-drop rule of white Euro ancestry. So if you have any European ancestry, you're white. It's symmetrical. It makes just as much sense or little sense as the any African ancestry makes you black, right? It's a logically symmetrical classification system. If we had a one-drop white rule as our cultural construction of race, there would be virtually no African Americans. Virtually everybody would be white, except for recent migrants from Africa, right? They conceivably would be not classified as white, but everybody else, certainly everybody with a slave history, would have some white ancestors because sexual relations between slave masters and slaves was rampant throughout the South. And so white ancestry got into the black population. Well, if a one-drop rule makes you black, a one-drop rule could make you white. And you can imagine some crazy racial ideology which would talk about how, you know, one drop of white blood would be enough to purify you if you had that kind of ideological view about races. Now, the point of this is just to say it's all arbitrary. There's nothing biological about a one-drop rule as a fact about human difference that matters. It's a socially created way of dividing people and classifying them into categories. All right, that's what race is, a socially constructed classification system based on biological categories, which are rendered social classifications through the way we do it culturally. What's racism then? Racism is a set of beliefs and social practices in which culturally defined racial classifications intersect forms of social oppression. Now, one could imagine in principle, although in practice I don't think it happens, a racial classification system that did not in any way overlap with forms of oppression, forms of exclusion, forms of domination, forms of exploitation. One could have it just as a classification system. So we have lots of classification systems which don't intersect forms of social oppression. Many of the hyphenated Americans of European descent are a classification system which don't intersect forms of oppression. So we have Irish Americans and Italian Americans and Welsh Americans and German Americans and Norwegian Americans around here. Go to Mount Horeb and see all the little troll statues on the main street of Mount Horeb, west of Madison. We have lots of people of European heritage, European descent, who do classify themselves on the basis of ancestry, but it doesn't correspond to any dominant forms of domination or oppression. It's more like taste. Indeed, that kind of classification has been sometimes referred to as salad bar ethnicity. Salad bar ethnicity means that for many Americans, they have multiple possible heritages because Irish married Catholic, married German, married Polish over many generations. And so they can identify with different strands of their family heritage depending upon what's fashionable. When John Kennedy was elected president, suddenly there were more Irish Americans on surveys than there had been before, because it became very fashionable to be Irish, of Irish descent. And it's not that people had denied that they were Irish, but they didn't particularly identify with it. And the identification was triggered by its social standing. Racism is different. It's not just a socially defined set of classifications based on biologically inherited attributes, biological descent, but it intersects forms of social oppression. And as a result, racism really always involves linking evaluative judgments to these classifications. In different times and places, there are different judgments, different evaluative judgments that get anchored or connected to the racial classification system: inferior, superior, worthy, unworthy, dangerous, not dangerous, honest, dishonest, hardworking, lazy. You can add to that list. It's all familiar. And that's really the hallmark of racism, is the combination of this social status disrespect that gets connected to the classification system and gets deeply ingrained and then gets reinforced through all sorts of mechanisms, all sorts of processes, sometimes by the state, as in the South, in a very official and formal way, other times more informally through various kinds of cultural practices. So that's our core concepts. Now, what we want to do in the rest of this lecture and the next lecture is, first of all, chart the ramifications of living in a society within which racial classifications play such a big role. I'll provide you with an historical perspective on the transformations of the character of racism. In doing that, I'm going to kind of break up the different types of racism in American history into a number of quite distinct forms, so that you'll understand this is a variable, not just a constant. It takes different forms. And then we'll do an assessment of, well, where are we now in the 21st century? What's the kind of current state of play? around this dimension of social inequality and domination, and I would argue social oppression. And then what can be done? What possible ways forward are there? It's a big agenda, lots to talk about. This will continue today for the rest of today and tomorrow's lecture as well. And I want to begin with a point that's not often made, and it might seem quite odd to actually begin our discussion of the empirical questions with this point, but I think it's important, and that is that racism in America doesn't only hurt the targets of racism, it actually hurts whites as well. Now, I'm not saying that the damage to whites by racism is worse or even remotely on a par with the harms generated on the targets of racism, but I do think it's important to see the problem of racism as an American problem that affects most people's lives one way or another, and affects it negatively, not just that it affects the people who are most deeply harmed by racism. That's an important point, I think, to recognize because it's part of the background understanding that makes a combined effort to struggle against racism more likely. If it were the case that all whites deeply benefited from racism and their lives would go worse in the absence of racism, if that were true, well, that would make it a much tougher thing to fight. Why is it that there are lots of white people who are opposed to racism? Well, in part, it's because it is false that their lives go better because of racism. That's not the only reason they fight against it. They do so for social justice and moral reasons. But it is an important feature of this phenomenon that it actually has this character of harming the perpetrators as well as the targets. So I want to just explain what's going on in that claim. And the claim, by the way, I'm not making a really lofty spiritual claim. That one could make that as well. One could make the claim that racism harms the lives of those who are racist because it makes for a degraded kind of life. A meaning in which your meaning is bound up with hate and despise of other people is an impoverished way of living. Well, I'm not going to make, that's an additional argument one can make about how being in an oppressor role is damaging to the oppressor. I'm not making that argument. I'm not rejecting that argument, but that's not the point I'm making here. The first point is that racism reduces social solidarity and weakens social movements for all oppressed groups, all disadvantaged groups, and it thus hurts poor whites and working class whites because it reduces the kind of social solidarity which would enable the disadvantaged population as a whole to collectively act in their interests. This is the classic problem that's called divide and conquer. Racism was a crucial weapon against labor organizing, for example, throughout the 19th and into the 20th century, and still is, although less so. That's less of a central strategy for weakening the labor movement today than it was at some points in the past. But bringing in minorities as strike breakers was a common tactic of employers when there was a strike. And they picked minorities precisely in order to intensify the conflict between the strike breakers and the strikers. Divide and conquer is the classic way that this is described. There's some interesting research that had the following character. So if you think that racism benefits the white working class, then one would expect where the wage difference between white and black workers was the greatest, white workers should be the best off. That is, they should be the beneficiaries of having a big racial gap in wages. Right, so if it is true that white workers are the main beneficiaries of the exclusionary practices that are part of the racial organization of labor markets, than you would expect in those cities in the United States where the gap in earnings between whites and blacks were biggest, would be also the places where white earnings were the highest. But that turns out to not be the case. If this was research done in the 1970s, I don't know if it's still true, but it was true in the 1970s. If you look at metropolitan areas in the United States and calculate the average earnings of whites and blacks, wage earners. So this isn't, this is putting aside the question of people who have earnings from investments. So this is just standard wages that we're talking about. If you looked at the ratio of white to black wages, the higher that ratio, that's the most inequality between whites and blacks, the lower the average wage of whites. Now that's consistent with the divide and conquer point, right? So where there's bigger divisions between whites and blacks, that's going to harm white workers as well. Well, that's the first sense in which racism can be thought to hurt not only minorities, but whites as well. And secondly, racism weakens support for universal programs. Universal programs of various sorts have the character of providing a benefit for everybody. And if the everybody in your world includes people who you despise, who you feel are unworthy, as a class, as a category, so if universal means including those people, then the political support for universalism goes down. And universalism benefits disadvantaged and poor white people as well as African Americans. Racism weakens the political support for universal programs. It's one of the reasons it's often argued why the United States has relatively fewer and less robust universal programs than in countries which aren't facing this kind of internal division within their population. Well, I'm not going to belabor this first point, that racism in America hurts not only minorities but whites as well. I just want you to keep that in mind as we now shift our focus to the way in which racism imposes real harms on people and communities. Let me just run down a kind of conventional list of some of these harms, and then we will explore this in much more detail. In the original Constitution, Indians, blacks, and other non-whites were counted as less than full persons. You know, this should be a familiar point. There was a great controversy in the forming of the Constitution over how to count black slaves in the South. This was the most salient problem in deciding what the populations were. Now, why did this matter? Because political representation in Congress depended upon population. Congressional districts were designed to have equal population. One delegate, one representative would be elected from each district. But how many people are in the district? Well, we don't count birds, right? We don't say how many living creatures are in your district. We don't feel that, the deer in Wisconsin, they don't vote, but they should still be counted. They should still be represented in Congress. No, we say people are represented. But what do you do if you have a substantial population of people who are not allowed by law to vote? Should you count them? Should the electoral districts in the South just be of whites, or should it be of everybody? Well, the compromise was to consider slaves as two-thirds of a person. That gave the South hugely disproportionate power in Congress, because only whites could vote, and indeed initially only white property owners could vote. But they got all these free votes counted in terms of how many of them could get elected. A white plantation owner who owned 500 slaves would, let's say 600, it makes it easier to calculate two-thirds, would be basically casting 400 votes when he went to the polls, because That's the way the representation system worked. Slaves were denied virtually all legal protections. Full citizenship for blacks was not enacted until 1964, just over a half a century ago. You know, until a half a century ago, African Americans in much of the country did not have full citizenship rights. Native Americans have been massively displaced from their original land, subjected to murderous repression and marginalization. And all of this is not just ancient history. You know, it'd be one thing if we're studying slavery in ancient Rome and asking the question, well, how does this affect modern Italy? Well, I'm sure a clever historian could trace certain features of the Italian social structure and the way agriculture was organized in the north and the south of Italy, which has something to do with the way the ancient Roman system of slavery occurred, but really that is ancient history. This is not ancient history in the United States, both in the sense that some of the most egregious forms of this oppression have only been eliminated in the lifetime of people living today, but furthermore, that many of the practices which came along with these particularly sharp forms of racial domination, many of the practices also continue today. All right, well, let's now turn to history. Historical trajectory of forms of racial domination. What I'm going to talk about here tracks the book pretty closely. But of course, in the book, there's more historical detail than I'll be able to give in the context of the lecture. I'm going to pursue this analysis of different kinds of racial domination and inequality and oppression in a roughly historical way. That is, I'm going to talk about things that were there from the present and then move from the very foundation of the United States. I'm going to turn this thing off before it. Okay. And then move to things that are more contemporary. But the more contemporary forms of racism were also present in the past. But this, I'm going to give a sequencing that really focuses on what's the most important form in different periods. All right. The first form of racism that really matters in American history is genocide. A heavy word, genocide. The word literally means the murder of a people. Ethnocide is the murder of an ethnicity. Genocide is the systematic policy to exterminate a particular category of persons because of their race, religion, ethnicity, or some other characteristic. Extermination is the objective, getting rid of them, having them disappear. In U.S. history, the treatment of Native Americans was often genocidal. I have a disturbing quote from Theodore Roosevelt. So Theodore Roosevelt is a quite revered president. He was noted for some major accomplishments. The National Park System, for example, was founded by Teddy Roosevelt. He was an outdoorsman of quite renown, famous for his military exploits in the Spanish-American War in Cuba, and is generally regarded with respect to the full spectrum of American presidents as both a good president, accomplished a lot, and a relatively progressive president. That is, he improved things with respect to a number of issues. And yet, Teddy Roosevelt said the following: "I suppose I should be ashamed to say that I take the Western view of the Indian. I don't go so far as to think that the only good Indians are the dead Indians, but I believe 9 out of 10 are, and I shouldn't inquire too closely into the case of the 10th. The most vicious cowboy has more moral principle than the average Indian." Now, that is a monstrous statement. I mean, it's just utterly morally reprehensible.
Goebbels could have said something like that about Jews. I mean, it is there's no excuse for it. And it's, you can't even really say, well, it was just part of the times. That's what everybody thought in 1886. No, it was not part of the times. It wasn't what everybody thought. There were people who opposed the Indian Wars, just like there were people who opposed slavery. It is not the case that at the time in which these sentiments were, you were allowed to say it out loud in public, that it was just a normal thing to say and everybody thought, oh, that's great, yeah, dead Indians, that's what we want. No, it's not. It was a genocidal, racist view of certain categories of people not being fully human and not deserving to live. And that is part of our history. So this, I think, really bears on contemporary issues. You know, Native Americans protest at various times for what they see as infringements on the rights that they were granted in the context of their massive defeat and marginalization. They have what are called treaty rights, which gave them various kinds of rights. And those treaty rights were imposed upon them, not freely chosen, imposed upon them, and then repeatedly violated time after time after time. And so when they protest today and are denigrated for their protests as somehow being a special interest or simply, you know, being out for their own land or their own priorities and not worrying about the welfare of others, it's really, to me, a lack of any historical perspective or empathy for the consequences of centuries of this degree of repression. The last massacre of Native Americans occurred less than 150 years ago. In the late, I think 1890 was the last major massacre by American troops of Native Americans. This is a deep and crucial part of our history. Some, those of you from Wisconsin probably know that there is periodic protests by white fishermen against the spear fishing privileges of Native Americans. Right? So Native Americans have treaty rights which enable them to do spear fishing in the lakes of northern Wisconsin. And depending upon the harvest in any given year and the assessment of the population of the fish in order to prevent the tragedy of the commons, right, destroying the fishing stock altogether, if the catch from the spear fishing season, which is only available to Native Americans, if that catch is of above a certain level, then white fishermen are not allowed to fish in that lake for that year. And whites protest that. They say this is unfair. You know, why do Native Americans get special privilege? Well, I think that is, that's basically the equivalent of me saying to the somebody who has a cottage on a lake and is protesting the fishing, saying, oh, well, I'm going to just come and sleep in your bed tonight because I want to. I'm going to ignore your property rights if this is your cottage. It's unfair that you have the privilege of sleeping in your bed and I can't do it. Well, of course, that's ridiculous. But that's essentially what the treaty rights gave the Native Americans. They have property rights in the fish in that lake. They gave up everything else, but as part of the apparent benevolence of the United States government when the final treaties were signed, the treaty rights for Native Americans gave them the rights to the fish in the lake and to manage the fish in the lake. So it's their property, and you have no right to complain about it. Okay, well, I'm repeating this because the racism against Native Americans is often not part of the discussion of race in America. Race in America has been so dominated for utterly understandable reasons by the problem of slavery and the subsequent and enduring problem of race around African Americans, that the racism that continues to exist and to create misery in the lives and harms in the lives of Native Americans is often not taken seriously, and it should, and it should be. And we should feel nothing but regret, not personal guilt. That is, I don't think that all of you who are American citizens, that you bear responsibility for the sins of the last century, of two centuries ago. for the genocidal policies against Native Americans? No. I don't believe that the sins of the father are, you know, carried on by the children. No, of course not. It's not that we should feel guilty about it, but we should feel guilty or ashamed about the current treatment given that history. And the fact that rectification of those harms is not taken seriously, that is something that our generation is responsible for. The second historical form of racism, slavery. Slavery is a system of social relations in which one person is the private property of another and can be bought and sold on a market. It's a simple idea. Slavery, however, comes in many forms. That is, you can have slavery in which one person owns another, but there's all sorts of regulations as to what you can do to the person you own. Just as there, you can have rules about how you can treat your animals, right? So we have animal treatment laws in the United States today, which means that if you are a person and have a dog kennel and are raising puppies to sell, and you violate certain codes about how you're supposed to treat the animals, how much space they're supposed to have, how they're supposed to be treated, you can have your puppies taken away from you. So we have pretty strict rules around animal welfare for farmers and for others. Or you could have a system where anything goes, where animals aren't important, you can treat them however you want. Well, so slavery comes in many varieties. American slavery is probably generally regarded as among the most extreme forms of slavery in any country. Certainly in contemporary history. Sometimes it's argued that the reason why slavery was such an extreme version here was precisely because the United States was founded on principles of liberty. It's an irony, right? We're founded on the principles of all men are created equal, endowed by their creator in certain inalienable rights. Inalienable rights, what about slaves? You had to have something to reconcile this astoundingly progressive humanistic Enlightenment era statement about what our aspirations as a country were. All men are created equal, say people are created equal these days, with the fact of slavery. Well, one argument for why slavery was so brutal here was the only way to reconcile those two principles, a country founded in liberty, a country founded on slavery. How do you reconcile those? The only way to do it is to treat slaves as animals, as subhuman. If you deny them their humanity, then you can reconcile because they aren't really, quote, men, the men, using the word men as the generic term for people. So U.S. slavery was extreme. Children could be taken from parents and sold at any time, as babies, as toddlers, children, adolescents. Slaves could be tortured and killed with virtually no restrictions. If a slave ran away, you could hobble them. You could cut off a foot or the toes of one foot to make it hard for them to run away again. And that was perfectly fine. And rape of slaves was never a crime. Rape of slaves was never a crime in the southern, in the slave parts of the country. It's really, especially the first of these is, I think, often taken as the most egregious social violation of the life of the community of slaves, the fact that children could be sold on a market at any time and that parents had no choice. And indeed, husbands and wives could be split up at the will of a slave master. Pretty extreme. And it continued until 1864. Slavery has this character that if you are going to have that kind of structure of social relations in a society for a couple of hundred years, and you're going to color code your slaves, slaves were black, the kind of ideology and views about the character of those people that gets built
in a very deep way in the culture, is very hard to eradicate.
Okay, slavery. Second-class citizenship. Second-class citizenship is a system of giving different categories of people different citizenship rights on the basis of some attribute. The idea of second-class citizenship doesn't just apply to racial categories. Women were second-class citizens in the United States until, particularly until the 1920s, but actually continued a bit until the 1930s. Until the 1930s, a married woman could not travel on her own passport. You know, it was a very strange set of rules about how passports were issued. You wouldn't have a passport in your own name. But until the 1920s, women couldn't vote. The justification for why they couldn't vote was that they weren't really rational enough. It was basically an argument about inferiority. And thus, it has some of the same character of denial of rights that went along with racism. Not as brutal, not as completely categorical. Women were seen as having many good qualities. But rationality and judgment was viewed to be sufficiently deficient that their vote would be utterly controlled by their husbands. And so if you gave women the right to vote, you were basically giving married men 2 votes. Well, of course, we know that's nonsense, and it reflects particular ideologies around gender, which we will be discussing next week when we talk about the transformation of gender relations. So second-class citizenship is not, my point is, it's not just restricted to race. But in the American context, the racialized form of second-class citizenship really played a decisive role in the development of current issues around race. After the Civil War, when slavery was abolished, the American government faced a big choice. There's a kind of one of these moments in history where you can imagine an entirely different history was possible, could have happened. You're at a switching point. You could have done one thing and the world would be very different today. You do another thing and the world is the way it is. So imagine if in 1865, right after the Civil War, when Reconstruction is beginning, we have a defeated secessionist nation, the South, occupied by the armies of the North. One possibility was that the plantations would be divided up and the land distributed to slaves. The slaves had worked these plantations for decades or longer, depends upon what part of the South you were. They were the workers who produced the wealth that the slave owners appropriated. It was unequivocally exploitation by the way we defined it in the past. You can imagine that, and there were radical Republicans. The Republican Party was the anti-slavery party. The radical Republicans, there were radical Republicans who said the plantation owners should be deprived of this, of their property rights and land, because they've been exploiting for, you know, 250 years, the labor of slaves. That's what made them rich. It's the least we can do to compensate the slaves for this inhumane appropriation of their very lives by slave owners to redistribute the land to them. And the slogan was 40 acres and a mule. That was considered the unconditional basic income, so to speak, right? That's, if you had 40 acres and a mule, you could support a family. So imagine if that had happened. Now just imagine, the plantations are broken up, the plantation owners are expropriated without compensation, and the slaves get the land. And then the Northern Army stays in the South long enough to protect the slaves from the vigilante guerrilla war that started pretty soon after against the North, you know, the Ku Klux Klan and other oppressions. Well, if that was able to be stabilized, it would have created a very different subsequent history. You would have had a yeoman farmer class among African Americans. Some of them would have become prosperous farmers, others not. You would have had class differentiation among the African American population as a result over time in the South. But they would have been a prosperous
component of the Southern economy and would have been able to defend their political rights as a result. Well, that's not what happened. The plantation owner's property remained intact. And as a result, the plantation owners faced the problem. How are we going to get our former slaves to work on our land effectively? And they tried various things and eventually settled on a form of sharecropping, a particular way of subordinating people on the land, enforced by Jim Crow laws, which gave blacks and whites different rights. The Jim Crow laws disenfranchised the African American population. It introduced segregation in all public facilities and in schooling, had many other ramifications as well. Vagrancy laws in the South were introduced as part of this era as a way of criminalizing African Americans looking for jobs without work. If you were unemployed and looking for a job, you were defined as a vagrant and could be arrested and jailed as a result. That was part of the repressive machinery to keep, quote, blacks in their place. These laws were introduced in a kind of piecemeal way in the beginning in the 1870s and 80s, but really by the end of the century, consolidating. One of the most poignant stories about the development of Jim Crow laws and the power of this segregationist strategy in the South concerns the liberal arts college Berea College in Kentucky. You should look at it online. It's an extremely interesting liberal arts college. I spent a few days there a few years ago giving some lectures and got their proud history. So the basic history of Berea College was right after the Civil War, it was refounded. It started just before the Civil War as an integrated liberal arts college in Kentucky. It was closed down during the Civil War and then reopened right after the Civil War, again as an integrated liberal arts college with equal numbers of black and white students. And then they became coeducational very early. They also bought the land around the college, the town of Berea, and required that the housing be alternately black and white. So they had completely integrated neighborhoods in the town. And this continued throughout the next couple of decades. The college thrived. When interracial dating started, because you had boys, young men and young women, black and white, that, of course, was a great scandal when black and white young people were seen going out together in whatever that means exactly under 19th century cultural forms of going out together. But the college defended it and said, what do you expect? We're an integrated school. We have young men and young women here. Of course they'll go out together. Well, the state of Kentucky, once it started introducing the Jim Crow laws, banned integrated schools, including private schools. It said race mixing is an abomination, and it said the Berea College had to segregate. Berea College appealed this all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court of the United States affirmed the right of the state of Kentucky to make it illegal for a private liberal arts college to admit both black and white students. And so Berea was forced to divide. What it decided to do was to divide its endowment and establish a black college, I believe in Louisville. So the spirit of its integrationist principles continued. After desegregation, of course, it reintegrated. It now has a policy of no tuition. It's free. It relies on heavy donations, and it's got a pretty big endowment so that it can have free tuition for all students. But also, it only admits students whose family income is below, I think, the 40th percentile. It just won't admit anybody from a rich family. So it has this crazy policy of having free tuition which makes it very competitive to get into. It's competitive in the way that, you know, Princeton and Yale are competitive. Very high number of applicants relative with a low admission rate, but it admits people who are unlikely to, well, they don't have rich parents, and if they're successful in life, their children won't be able to go there. And yet, they get enough donations from alumni to be able to sustain this model. Well, it's a super interesting bit of history. Okay, this is a big digression, using up valuable minutes for important issues. The point is to just show you how vicious the Jim Crow laws were to destroy a college like that with those principles on the grounds that race mixing was an abomination. One of the accompaniments of the Jim Crow era and this highly repressive racialized state structure were lynchings of African Americans. This is a chart of lynchings per year, and as you can see, in the period when the Jim Crow laws were being instituted at the end of the 19th and early 20th century, lynchings increased dramatically. The fourth type of racism, semi-free labor. This is a system for including non-citizens in a labor market without giving them the rights and protections of citizenship. Semi-free labor. This continues today. We have various ways of including non-citizens in our labor market without giving them rights and protections of citizenship. In the 19th century, this was true for Chinese labor, often called coolie labor. That was absolutely crucial for the building of the railroads in the western half of the United States. In the 21st century, this is the case for illegal aliens. Illegal aliens, so-called, undocumented workers, undocumented immigrants, different terms for describing the same phenomenon. Undocumented workers fill an important role in the labor market. That's obvious. They are employed throughout the country, both in personal services for people. You know, we have time and time again some politician who is denouncing illegal immigrants. It's then shown that they had undocumented workers as their housekeepers or their nannies. They fill an important role in the American labor market, just as other semi-free labor. Now, the key issue of semi-freeness is that you lack the citizenship rights, which protect you from various kinds of abuse. And that continues today. Mostly, when you've had categories of semi-free labor, it's been racialized. It's not that it's intrinsic. There are, of course, undocumented workers from Ireland and Britain, from Canada, for that matter, in the United States. That's not what is seen as the problem. The problem is undocumented workers who also can be considered a racial category. And finally, the fifth type or form of racism goes under the rubric of discrimination. Discrimination is a form of racism in which persons are accorded full citizenship rights, but in various ways they face systematic private discrimination in various contexts. This may be officially illegal, but it's widely tolerated in practice. Discrimination, of course, existed in all the other forms of racism. It accompanies each of the others. And it's, of course, likely to be most intense when it's backed up by one of the other forms of racism. So the forms of discrimination of African Americans in the era of Jim Crow, the discrimination of African Americans outside of the South, was much sharper than it is today in certain respects. And partially that was because it was part of a system in which the harsher forms of racial domination inscribed in law were already also present. Discrimination is a form of racism in which persons are given a formally full citizenship rights, but in practice, in various ways, they face
systematic discrimination in certain contexts. We will, in the next lecture, look at the way discrimination actually works and why it remains an important and pernicious form of racial domination and reproducing racial inequality, even if it's also true that as a culture, we have no longer to see discrimination as a morally justified way of treating people. And we will continue this next week by discussing the current situation of race in America. See you then.